gentlemen. The first case this morning is Dexia Credit versus Rogan. Mr. O'Rourke.
Honorable Judges of the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, good morning. My name is Michael O'Rourke. I, along with Timothy Toohey, is with me at council table, represent the appellants in this matter, Brian Rogan, Robert Rogan, and Caitlin Rogan, this appeal. Your Honor, we have decided to divide up the presentation in the two parts. Our opening presentation, we will give for 12 minutes, and then 8 minutes we have reserved respectfully for rebuttal. Mr. Toohey will present the rebuttal argument on behalf of appellants. Your Honors, we are here to urge reversal by this court of the District Court's July 7, 2009 entry of final judgment terminating the interests of appellants in their domestic and foreign trusts. We urge reversal on 10 grounds. We have cited those in our brief. Here I would like to concentrate, Your Honors, on four of those grounds. The first and foremost, we urge that the district court lack subject matter jurisdiction to hear this matter at the outset. Dexia entered into a participation agreement assigning co-ownership of the subject letter of credit with LaSalle Bank of Chicago prior to the filing of the suit that underlied this action. That participation agreement was entered into in July of 1999. That participation co-ownership, a credit syndicate, if you will, created an unincorporated association, which under this court's very consistent line of precedent dating from at least Indiana Gas 1998 forward through other cases that have come before this court. The court has consistently held that the members of all of the unincorporated association must all be considered. Their citizenship must all be considered for diversity purposes. LaSalle Bank of Chicago was an Illinois citizen. There were defendants at the outset of this case that were Illinois citizens. Jurisdiction under diversity jurisdiction principles was lacking, and this case should never have gone forward.
Let me ask you this, Mr. O'Rourke.
Sure.
What workable rule do you propose for determining when entities form an unincorporated association that requires consideration of each entity's citizenship for jurisdiction purposes?
I think that the court's opinion in Indiana Gas is instructive. It says that if you have a corporation, that's one thing. If you have a unit which consists of, which is unincorporated and consists of members who have associated for for that particular transaction or with respect to that particular asset, you have an unincorporated association. There is, I would say that you have to concentrate on the real fundamentals of the transaction. What you are dealing with here was a co-ownership of this letter of credit. It is much more of an active relationship than a trade union, limited partnership. If you look at the actual realities of the transaction, these two entities were in fact joined as co-owners. I believe that within the Indiana Gas and within the other Belleville Catering and the Meyerson cases that this court has looked at relating to unincorporated association, that they qualify. So I would say that you have to look at the realities of the transaction and really, is there direct interest rather than a derivative interest. There was a direct interest by both participants. They were co-owners. They were directly they were directly entitled to recover directly on the letter of credit. There was an assignment of the rights. There was an assignment of the responsibilities. And I guess the best way to explain is that the realities of the transaction cry out for unincorporated association because the realities of that transaction. I think it has to be looked at. And certainly in Indiana Gas, the insurance syndicate is very analogous to the loan syndicate formed here, Your Honor.
So your bottom line, I take it from what you've said, is that any time two companies enter into a risk-sharing agreement, they form an unincorporated association.
I believe that is correct when they have direct risk involved, and then both of them have essentially a joint interest in that transaction. Excuse me, Your Honor. That would constitute an unincorporated association for diversity purposes. Certainly in this case, Your Honor, and at the minimum, Dexia should have disclosed this participation at the outset so that the relationship could have been scrutinized at the outset so that it could have been determined whether or not federal court jurisdiction was appropriate. It was not, and was not disclosed in 2004 when it was amended. We found out about it, Your Honor, the record would disclose, in April of 2009 during the trial of this matter when the Dexia representative testified. And disclosed that. Judge Kennelly wasn't aware of it either. The second, Your Honor, any further?
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. O'Rourke, I had one question on same issue. Has any court in the United States determined that financial institutions entering into participation agreements are an unincorporated association?
We are unable, Your Honor, respectfully, to point out any case which has these facts and where a loan syndicate has been ruled to be an unincorporated association. We argue, Your Honors, by analogy, certainly akin to Indiana Gas. One of the things is this is really more of a Lloyd's case than Indiana Gas. The rights of LaSalle are much more prominent than were the rights of the insurance syndicate members in Lloyd's, Your Honor. Secondly, the second point, statute of limitations. We believe that Judge Kennelly misapplied or applied an erroneous statute of limitation with regard to the claims that were heard in this turnover proceeding. He applied the enforcement of judgment statute under Illinois law, which is not, Your Honors, I respectfully suggest, a statute of limitations whatsoever. It is a statute which sets out the time frame within which you can enforce a judgment, not sets out the time frame within which a claim becomes a judgment. And in doing so, Your Honor, we think that that was a very, very serious error and which can have long-term repercussions if it's not corrected. The statute of limitations on constructive trust in Illinois is 5 years. It is not 7 years under a judgment statute, and that, we believe, needs to be corrected. The claims of Dexia, we would suggest, are time-barred, both under this and under the Florida statute of repose, which we have argued in our brief, control the domestic trusts in this case. They are clearly Florida trusts. Florida law governs the actions against such a trust under Florida law. 12 years is the limit within which an action can be brought against those trusts. And because these trusts were formed and funded by 1994, the claims of Dexia are time-barred. Yes, Your Honor.
Mr. O'Rourke, the Dexia claims that the Rogan children didn't raise this specific defense under the Illinois statute of limitations until post-judgment briefing in this appeal. Is that correct?
No, we brought it up, Your Honor, in our statement of claim. We in our statement of claim, which we filed, I believe, in October of 08, that
post-judgment?
Hearing on the turnover proceeding, Your Honor, we raised it right away in our statement of claim, which preceded the actual trial of this matter, which proceeded in 2009. So we raise it all along, and we continue to raise it before the court in arguments and in motions. I also would like to say that Robert Rogin, Your Honors, is not subject to a personal jurisdiction in Illinois. We made a motion. Terminating of his interest, we believe, was improper. And we filed an affidavit stating his lack of contacts with Illinois, terminating his interest, we believe, was improper. The fourth major point, Your Honors, is that in a supplemental proceeding under Illinois law and as applicable in federal court, the issue is before the court is our citation respondents before the court that are in possession of assets subject to turnover to the judgment creditor. And that is the scope of the proceeding as articulated in the Shack versus Bloom decision, the Pisos versus Heartland Development decision, and as recognized by this court in its Star Insurance decision in March of 2009. Dexia presented no evidence that any citation respondent before the court at the turnover hearing was in possession of any assets at all of the judgment debtor, Peter Rogin. Certainly, Judy Rogin did not, who was a citation respondent. Peter Rogin did not. He has no assets. And the trustee, Fred Cuppy, was removed prior to the time that the turnover order was conducted before Judge Cannelli.
So your point is that this proceeding went well beyond the scope of supplementary proceedings.
Went well beyond and also did not conclude properly. There was not a proper conclusion of that because he entered judgment before proof was presented, Your Honor, that citation respondents before the court had possession of assets so that they could be subject to a turnover. That citation respondent, make it, Citicorp, turn over those stock certificates, or Bank of Bellevue, turn over that account. None of that happened. In fact, today, Your Honors, we still don't know what assets are in these trusts.
Well, let me ask you this. Sure. If this wasn't the right procedure, how, in your view, should Dexia have proceeded after it obtained the judgment against Peter Rogin and had reason to believe that the trust held assets from his fraudulent activities?
They should have proceeded, by citations on the trust and on the banks which held those assets. The Citigroup, Smith Barney, held assets. There was never a citation served on Smith Barney. There was never a citation served on some of the other entities which held assets, including I think the CD Ameritrade. The proceeding against the trustee Rogin, Fred Cuppy, would have been fine, except Fred Cuppy was removed. Now he should have been replaced, and there was an order entered calling for replacement in October of 2008 that was never followed up on. So at the end of the day, Fred Cuppy was not in possession of assets because he'd been removed, and he was never really questioned at trial as to what assets he held. So, Your Honor, the proper procedure was get citation of the person with possession of assets and get a turnover order on him. And when you're at the turnover hearing, make sure he has the assets. If he's gotten rid of the assets, then you have contempt powers under the citation procedures to take action, or the judge can order another trustee appointed, which should have happened in this case. It did not. I've run through my time. Thank you very much.
Let me ask you one question though, before you sit down. Does Mr. Cuppy have any interest in this case?
He has no interest right now in this particular case. He is within the overall case answering on citations that were directed against him personally.
But not the outcome of this particular case.
I don't believe so, no, Your Honor. Thank you so much, Judge.
Mr. Mendoff.
If it pleases the court, Scott Mendoff on behalf of Dexia. I'm going to limit my responses to the items that were covered in the opening and will assume that they will not be exceeded in the reply section of this. Starting with the subject matter jurisdiction point, The arguments that are made here regarding LaSalle and Dexia are fatally flawed for four reasons. One, they waived the bulk of these arguments already. Second, they failed to account for the real party and interest rule. Third, they failed to account for substantial Seventh Circuit law, which goes directly against them. And fourth, the case law that they cited, we heard about Indiana Gas, is inapposite. On those points, I'm going to focus on the key aspects. Our briefs cover the details. But as to the waiver point, the only theory that appellants addressed below was that this was an unincorporated association because it was akin to a partnership or a joint venture. They have jettisoned that argument on appeal. Judge Kennelly rejected that argument, and they do not make it on appeal. Instead, they make a new argument, which they did not make below. And they assert that the district court should have considered other types of unincorporated associations beyond joint ventures and partnerships. But they don't specify in any of their briefing what those other types of unincorporated associations should be. The argument, the question that was raised by Your Honor, Judge Williams, is exactly the point that was not addressed. They did not say what kind of unincorporated association should be covered. And they failed to develop this argument because they don't specify that, and they don't cite any case law supporting the position that they argued in front of Your Honor. The argument they were making today, that for the first time, by the way, that the type of unincorporated association that should be encompassed here would be unincorporated associations where there is a direct interest rather than a derivative interest would not even apply to the facts in this case. There's no question that LaSalle's interest here was wholly derivative of Dexia's. We heard about the assignment of rights and responsibilities. Well, the rights and responsibilities under the participation agreement are all Dexia's. This is Dexia's business deal that LaSalle came in on after the fact. Dexia had the business relationship on the letter of credit with Edgewater Hospital. LaSalle took a participation interest in that. It was Dexia that was on the front line. It was Dexia that had the direct risk. LaSalle's risk was entirely derivative. The two cases that we cite in our brief are on this point are directly support what I'm saying. The Farman versus Harza Engineering case and CCC Information. In Farman versus Harza Engineering, which the appellants do not address in their reply brief, the underlying case shows that participation agreements are independent of contractual arrangements on which suit is that are independent of contractual relationships on which a suit is brought do not provide a sufficient basis to require consideration of the citizenship of the participant. CCC Information is exactly the same point. The court refused to consider the citizenship of third parties to a contract who nonetheless received a benefit from that contract. And the court held that a party that receives a trickle-down benefit, as LaSalle does here, is irrelevant to the suit for jurisdictional purposes. Judge Springman specifically asked whether there is any case that supported this proposition that participation interests are somehow a basis for including that party in the subject matter jurisdiction consideration, and we heard that there are not. But there are three cases that go directly against them on that, and we cite them in our brief. First National Bank of Belleville, Midland National Bank, and Farrell Construction are all cases involving participation arrangements, and in all those cases, the participant is not considered pertinent. The crux of the analysis is that in the context of a suit between contracting parties over their contract, the Seventh Circuit has made clear in Farman and CCC Information that a private participation agreement between one of the contracting parties and a third party to the third party participant does not create the kind of relationship that requires consideration of the participant's citizenship. Turning to the cases that the defendants, that the appellants focus on, Indiana Gas and Elston, both of those cases involve partnerships or determinations by the court that the relationship is akin to a partnership. Here, Judge Cannelli found that this was not akin to a partnership, and that that part of the argument has that part of the decision has not been appealed. Turning to the beyond the scope argument, the appellants argue that the proceedings are beyond the scope for a couple of different reasons. They didn't articulate that in their argument today, although they did reference the beyond the scope point. One of the reasons they say it was beyond the scope is because there was not a valid judgment at the time that the citations were issued. What happened, what they refer to is the fact that there was a jurisdiction spoiler lying in connection with the case, which Judge Cannelli only identified during the supplemental proceedings. And so at the time that the certifications were served, the argument is that the citations were invalid because the judgment was not final. Judge Cannelli resolved that with an order striking the jurisdiction spoilers and under Rule 21, which relates back to the beginning of the case. Case law in Newman Green, LeBlanc versus Cleveland, SCS Communication, and Long versus DC all make clear that when there's a Rule 21, a striking of a party, that that goes back to the beginning of the case, and the case is treated as if that party was not there throughout the entire case. So as a result, the citations were valid when they were issued. On the question of whether Star, on the related point regarding scope of relief, and the question of whether Star Insurance permits the kind of proceeding that happened here, the appellants are pressing a point of law which has no support in any case in Illinois or this court. They are saying that courts may not adjudicate substantive property rights of judgment debtors or third parties. They cite in support of that Valore, which is a Fifth Circuit case which interprets the Texas enforcement statute, which is materially different from Illinois, and Star Insurance, the decision of this court. But Star Insurance does not say that courts may not adjudicate substantive property rights. Star Insurance only says that veil piercing is not appropriate for a supplementary proceeding. It's limited to veil piercing. It does not extend to all substantive property rights. In fact, appellant's opening brief, after they make this argument, on page 42 of their opening brief, they reverse themselves on this very argument when they say, quote, that section 214.02, which is the provision in the code that deals with supplementary proceedings, they say, quote, provides a mechanism by which a judgment creditor can initiate proceedings to discover assets of a judgment debtor or a third party and apply those assets to satisfy the judgment. Discover assets of a third party and apply those assets. It's an adjudication of a substantive property right of the third party. And in fact, Schack versus Bloom, the case they cite, says that the provisions of 1402 should be construed broadly. But we don't stop there, because there are a whole series of cases which we cite which specifically say that Illinois law affirmatively allows the adjudication of third-party substantive property rights in supplemental proceedings. The decision in Ruggiero specifically affirmed an order of turnover in a situation very similar to this. There, the assets were held in the name of the judgment debtor's wife, and the court affirmed the turnover order requiring the wife to transfer those assets, convey those assets back to the husband so they can be executed upon. Elmhurst Auto same thing. Determine rights of third parties and property. Heritage Bank, same thing.
Before you move on to another point, in finding that it was acting within the proper scope of supplementary proceedings, the district court concluded that Dexia had mislabeled its claims at times. Shouldn't we take a party's word as to what its theory is and how it's proceeding?
Well, I'm happy you raised that, Judge Williams, because, in fact, we believe that the court is in error. The district court was in error when it said that. What the district court was focusing on is that we were referring in our theory to collecting on these assets under an alter ego slash nominee theory. There is a line of case law that calls executing on the assets of another when it appears that one person is transferred control but not ownership of an asset to a third party, or transfer the assets to a third party, but the first party really owns it. There's a line of cases that call that alter ego. There's another line of cases that use alter ego in relation to veil piercing. The appellants are seizing on that distinction to try to create an issue here. But in fact, there are cases that we've cited, including the Magaza case, which call the first type, the ownership inquiry, if you will, alter ego. Secondly, Your Honor, in arguing that this alter ego point, we have throughout this case, from the opening TRO motion and turnover motion through to the end, argued alter ego slash nominee. The nominee theory is unequivocally one of ownership. And so it has been clear throughout that when we said alter ego, we meant the iteration of alter ego that is applied in the cases that I was just mentioning, and not veil piercing. In fact, there is no corporation here for which there could have been a veil pierced. Veil piercing is just flatly irrelevant to this case, and the only reason it's arisen on appeal is because it's a hook to try to argue that we exceeded our scope when we didn't. If that answers Your Honor's question, I'll proceed. The other issue with regard to scope that I wanted to emphasize is that in the opening brief, appellants make the argument that Dexia exceeded the scope of the court exceeded the scope of in the supplementary proceeding regarding its adjudication of alter ego issues. It did not mention constructive trust issues. It only mentioned alter ego issues. It was only in the reply brief that they attempted to later on add in the constructive trust issues into the theory. So that's something that they have not raised before. And in fact, because they raised it in their reply brief only, we didn't get a chance to respond on that. But Illinois courts are clear that constructive trusts are appropriate in supplementary proceedings. I can provide the court with cites if the court is interested, but we had moved for a surreply brief because of all the issues that were raised in the reply and that was denied, so I don't want to exceed the bounds of what the court believes is proper. But this issue regarding constructive trust was only raised in the reply, and I will just tell the court there are cases, Illinois state cases, that specifically permit the imposition of constructive trust following the issuance of a citation to discover assets. Turning to statute of limitations and statute of limitations argument, here too we have still another waiver issue. In the appellant's opening brief, they argue that Dexia's constructive trust claims are barred by the Illinois statute of limitations. Constructive trust claims, Illinois statute of limitations. There's no mention of Florida law at all. They argue separately that Dexia's entire case is barred by the Florida statute of repose. Their opening brief fails to offer any reason why Florida law should permit govern the repose period, but Illinois law should govern the statute of limitations period. In our reply brief, we note that the only basis for applying Florida law is the provision within the trust, which states that Florida law should be used to interpret the trust. And we say that appellants did not make any kind of choice of law analysis to support their argument that Florida law should apply. For the first time in their reply brief, they did three different things. First, they said that statute of limitations should the statute of limitations, Texas cases are barred on cases barred on statute, under statute of limitations for both alter ego and constructive trust, not just constructive trust. Opening, they talk about constructive trust. In reply, they add alter ego. They argue for the first time that the Florida statute of limitations should apply in the statute of limitations argument. In the opening brief, they only talk about the Illinois statute of limitations. And to support their argument that the Florida statute of repose should be used, they argue for the first time choice of law principles. They never argued choice of law principles in their opening brief. We pointed out we did not argue choice of law principles in our reply. We only said that they didn't raise choice of law principles. And then we see in the reply brief an entire full-blown choice of law analysis. If that had been included in the opening brief, we would have responded. We're capable of responding, and we can dispel that argument, but it wasn't raised in the opening brief. Under statute of limitations, we heard the argument here that the 7-year statute of limitations on judgment enforcement does not apply. That is the first time that has been argued in this appeal. It was not argued in any of the briefing. The position in their briefing is that the 5-year statute of limitations on constructive trust applies and the 7-year statute of limitations on judgment enforcement applies, and Dexia violated the statute of trust, the constructive trust statute of limitations. Now we hear that the statute of limitations on judgment enforcement doesn't apply at all, first time. Their arguments under statute of limitations fail for four reasons. They were waived for a different reason than we've talked about before, separate waiver argument. The district court applied the correct statute of limitations, and the statute of limitations the appellants are advancing is incorrect, and that the appellants rely on inapposite case law. And even accepting appellants' view, the proper statute of limitations that the proper statute of limitations was 5 years, if the start and stop dates are looked at accurately, which they don't do, this was adjudicated in time. First, on waiver, and this goes to Judge Springman's question. Appellants failed to raise Illinois statute of limitations until their post-judgment briefing. If they don't waive it, the Seventh Circuit case in L.S. Heath & Sons specifically says that if statute of limitations is not adequately waived in the answer or in the summary judgment motion, it is waived. Now, we heard the argument from Mr. O'Rourke that, well, they raised it in their answer. What they said in their answer was, quote, all claims of Dexia to claimant's property are barred by the applicable statute of limitations. This is inadequate to preserve that defense. And National Council of Corporate Insurance and Surface Shields, Inc., both cases held that conclusory allegations do not state the applicable limitations period do not preserve the defense. Conclusory allegations that do not state the applicable limitations period do not preserve the defense. They did not state that they were seeking to apply Illinois statute of limitations here until the post-trial briefing. As to what is the proper statute of limitations, they are arguing that there should not be, that the statute of limitations with respect to judgment enforcement should not apply. But there are a whole series of cases that we have cited, Davila, Petom, and Bell, which all say that that is exactly what should apply. And They say that in the context of there being another statute of limitations at issue, which they say is for the underlying claim, cause of action, and as a result, that one does not apply. Only the judgment enforcement statute of limitations applies. I'm out of time, Your Honors. If you have any other questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Thank you.
May it please the Court. Judges, my name is Timothy J. Tuohy. I was trial counsel in the trial court and counsel of record here. I represent Robert Rogan and Sarah Caitlin Rogan. I'd like to address the jurisdictional issue here and follow up on Judge Williams's question. The Dexia has identified four separate reasons, and I'm going to talk about the first two. Dexia says that the CCC decision is controlling and that Indiana Gas is inapplicable. I think if we look at this long line of cases, certainly that goes back to Indiana Gas and as far back as 1986 to Kanzelberger, what we see is that this court has said the first inquiry is, of course, citizenship, but when we're dealing with business entities or firms or unincorporated associations or even associations like Lloyd's of London in the Indiana Gas case, if the one entity, business entity, is a corporation, you look at that entity's citizenship or principal place of business. Anything else, unless it's a sole proprietor or an individual, we look at the members, all of the members. And an unincorporated association is every business entity that's not incorporated. And the terms that have been used by this court over the years is business enterprise, firm, unincorporated association, a syndicate. It includes a Lloyd's of London syndicate, unincorporated associations such as unions, partnerships, limited partnerships. All those are unincorporated associations. On the other hand, if we compare CCC, the case that Dexia relies upon, that was a situation in which there were two corporations involved, and the question was, which corporation was the real party in interest? That has no application here because we don't have a business entity that had members or partners or individuals who were names in the insurance pool. The real party in interest argument that they make, that is a red herring because the real party in interest are the people or the entity that has the opportunity or the right to make a recovery. And we're not talking, and I know there's a distinction between the trickle-down and the real party in interest. This trickle-down idea comes from the fact that the money might end up in a corporate coffer, and it would trickle down to the shareholders or to the directors. But that's not the case here. There was no trickling involved. If we look at the participation agreement, it shows an undivided ownership interest that LaSalle had. It shows absolute obligations. It shows a division of money. It says that the agreement can't be modified except with the consent of the parties. And it also shows that if Dexia doesn't prosecute its claim to that money, that LaSalle has an equal right to step into their shoes and to take over and prosecute that claim. Here is an entity, not just risk sharing, but more than that, profit sharing, ownership, undivided ownership, and absolute right to collect underneath that agreement. That is the kind of business entity that every member or shareholder has to be analyzed for the purpose of determining citizenship, and that did not occur. Judge Kennelly's decision in his memorandum opinion says, we don't think this is a partnership. And the reason we do not think this is a partnership is because The agreement specifically says there's no fiduciary duty. And because there's no fiduciary duty, it could not be a partnership. And that's wrong for two reasons. First, because the provision that he relies upon, which is 7D, says there isn't a fiduciary duty between these two financial institutions except with regard to the money that they are going to be dividing up. So there is a fiduciary relationship. Second, Judge Kennelly did not complete his analysis because Judge Kennelly said, well, if it's not a partnership because of the lack of a fiduciary duty, then that means it cannot be an unincorporated association. And what I suggest is that the analysis is, if it is not a corporation and there's more than two entities, which there are here, then it is an unincorporated association or a business entity or some sort of risk-sharing agreement that implicates two parties. The trickle-down, if we compare that, would be money trickling down from the top, from the corporation coffers down to the shareholders or whoever. There was no trickling here. What would have happened is Dexia would have received the money and then handed it, not trickled it, but handed it pro rata to LaSalle. The real party in interest, therefore, is not a derivative. There was no derivative here. There was a division under an agreement, a risk-sharing agreement and a profit-sharing agreement. Final comparison. When there's a trickle-down, a shareholder doesn't have an absolute right to any of that money, nor does anybody in the corporate setting. But in this case, that's different because Dexia, if it got that money, had to give the pro rata share to LaSalle. There was a contractual agreement in this business enterprise. Now, with respect to the mislabeling, I understand that this court can affirm on any ground in the record, but the distinction that we would like to emphasize here, which came up in Starr, is that supplementary proceedings are for the purpose of obtaining money that would be fraudulently conveyed. And I use that term in a broad fashion because it's already been identified that those funds are, in this case, it's been identified they were Peter Rogan's funds. That would be a fraudulent transfer. Had Mr. Rogan transferred that money to a family member or to his wife, like on Ruggiero. But that didn't happen here. There was the transfer back in 1992 through 1994. And if that was when the transfer was, that's just too far back in time. That's the reason that they had to argue alter ego. If they wanted to do the right thing here, there had to be an independent action between Dexia and whoever the entity was to pierce the corporate veil once there was a judgment in their favor, in Dexia's favor. Then they can go and get Peter Rogan's money from the corporation or the entity whose veil they pierced, unless the court has any questions.
Thank you, counsel. Thanks to all counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.